35 states have laws that make it a crime for anyone who is HIV positive to not disclose that status before having sex with a partner. In 29 of those states, it's a felony to expose someone to HIV, even if the infected person has taken measures to protect the partner and whether or not the virus is actually transmitted. These laws are controversial, and many of the cases reveal the problems of mixing law enforcement and public health concerns. Well, freelance journalist Sergio Hernandez's investigation into the matter, Sex, Lies, and HIV, When What You Don't Tell Your Partner is a Crime, was co-published by BuzzFeed and ProPublica. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You found 541 cases in which people were convicted of or pleaded guilty to criminal charges for not disclosing that they were HIV positive to a partner. Do we know how often prosecutors bring charges under these laws?
We don't have a comprehensive number, but we did look at data from about 19 different states, and we actually found, including convictions, something like 1,400 cases, which would be a mix of convictions, arrests, actual charges filed in court.
Well, how do these cases come about? Does it require the sexual partner to make a complaint?
Not necessarily. In a couple of cases we found, you know, for instance, a Missouri case involving a prostitute in which the police actually brought the complaint through a sting operation. In a lot of the cases, it is a sexual partner who has made the complaint.
How often do these cases result in jail time?
It's hard to say because we don't have the whole universe of charges, so we can't say that the convictions that we found, we don't really have sort of a denominator there to say whether or not it's you know, what the proportion is. But, in about 29 states, it's a felony, and 35 states actually have these laws. And
Was the maximum sentence you came upon?
Nick Rhodes' case, that's the case that we profiled in the story, his was 25 years. But we did find a couple of instances here and there where you would see sentences of like 30 years.
We'll get to Nick Rhodes' case in a moment, but I still want to keep it a bit more general. Haven't HIV-positive people done time for spitting and biting others, even for scratching?
Yeah. There are a couple of states in which the law specifically makes it illegal to spit on or bite or scratch, for instance, a law enforcement officer, so a prison guard or a police officer or an EMT.
But hasn't it been determined medically that the HIV virus is not in saliva?
That's right. So the CDC says, you know, you cannot get HIV through saliva or through scratching. You can get it through biting if it's a very severe bite and there's lots of tissue damage involved and there's blood contact, but even those cases are extremely rare.
So what kind of penalty would an HIV-positive person face for those kinds of assaults versus someone who isn't HIV-positive?
So the example that we use is in Nebraska, where if you are HIV-negative and you spit on a police officer or a guard, it's a misdemeanor, it's a small fine, it's, I think, a couple of months in jail. If you're HIV positive, it's something like a $10,000 fine and I think 5 years in prison.
So critics are saying that these laws criminalize being HIV positive.
Right. So the term that a lot of the sort of advocacy community uses is HIV criminalization. And they argue that these cases, you know, very much stigmatize the disease further and might even deter people from going and knowing their status.
On the other hand, isn't there a real concern that the HIV-positive person is putting the partner in danger of also becoming HIV-positive?
It kind of depends on the circumstances of each individual case. There are certain, for instance, sexual acts that pose very little risk. If you're HIV-positive and you're on treatment and you've suppressed the amount of the virus in your body to a certain degree, the chances of passing it on to a partner are very small.
So should these laws be revised to get more specific?
There are some efforts to do that. In Iowa, for instance, there's a big push to update the law there and make it sort of a tiered system in which, depending on whether the person intended to infect their partner or whether transmission actually occurred, the severity of the penalty would be different.
But right now, people can be sentenced to years, sometimes even decades in prison, even if there was no transmission of HIV.
Exactly.
And nobody's making that distinction in those cases?
They've put together that argument. Again, the case that we looked at in the story, which is now on appeal, the lawyers in that case have argued, you know, this person used a condom. He was clearly actually trying to prevent transmission. the law doesn't explicitly take that into consideration.
And then there could be another kind of situation where someone is infected but had a number of partners who were HIV positive. How do you determine which one was responsible?
Right. So the only way you would be able to do that is you would have to run some pretty sophisticated and expensive DNA tests to match the strain of HIV in the accuser and the accused. And you know, we didn't find any cases where that happened.
We're talking with Sergio Hernandez, whose article Sex, Lies, and HIV, When What You Don't Tell Your Partner Is a Crime, has been published by BuzzFeed and ProPublica. And as you mentioned, you discussed the case of Nick Rhodes. What happened to him?
So Nick Rhodes is an Iowa man who, in 2008, he met another man online, and they had a one-night sexual encounter, and he did not disclose that he was HIV positive. And a couple of nights later, this guy, Adam Plendel, finds out through a mutual friend that Nick was HIV positive. And he goes to the hospital seeking a prescription of something called post-exposure prophylaxis, which is like a regimen of HIV drugs, which if you're exposed to the virus and you start taking it within 72 hours, it can actually prevent the virus from taking root.
But there's no indication that he had been infected.
No, but they did have unprotected oral sex, and that, you know, kind of sent him into sort of a panic, and so he went to the hospital to just cover his bases. And then at the hospital, an ER nurse actually called the police and reported it as a sexual assault. The police show up, they take Adam's statement, and then the case sort of spirals on from there.
Did Plendel request police involvement?
He says that he didn't. He says that the nurse at the ER was the one who called the police, and the police reports do substantiate that. But Adam did cooperate with the police throughout the investigation.
Are hospitals required to report something like this?
The hospital, this was a private nonprofit hospital in Iowa, and I didn't find anything in the law that requires them to report something like this.
So the nurse was taking it up on herself to do this?
It seems so. I mean, we contacted the nurse and the company that owns the hospital, and they didn't comment.
Well, Rhodes was then placed in solitary confinement.
Right.
Why solitary confinement? Were they trying to protect the rest of the prison population from this man?
The sheriff's office never commented on that, but he was placed in solitary confinement for a short period of time, and then he was he had a couple of opportunities to move to the general population, but he actually declined those, and he ended up sitting in jail for about a year before he pleaded guilty.
Well, he also attempted suicide at one point, didn't he?
Yes, so and a couple of times. When the police showed up with the arrest warrant to take him into custody, he had at that point known that he was under investigation and that he was in trouble, and he had attempted suicide, and he had actually been admitted to psychiatric care at the University of Iowa City.
Did he plan to fight the law in court?
Well, he pleaded guilty. He had a defense lawyer who had advised him to plead guilty and hope for a lenient sentence, but the judge actually gave him the maximum sentence. Then he spent about 9 months in prison and filed something called a reconsideration application. So he had his sentence reduced, and now he's appealing his case.
Well, he was sentenced to 25 years in jail.
Initially, he was sentenced to 25 years.
The maximum sentence for abusing a child in Iowa is 10 years.
Right.
And in this case, he didn't infect the person he was accused of potentially infecting.
He didn't infect anyone. He wore a condom. He was on medication, which suppressed the virus in his body. And experts say that, you know, if you're on treatment, you're actually something like 96% less likely to transmit the virus.
So, this became a newspaper story. How did it play with the public in Iowa?
It's been interesting in Iowa. He seems to have a lot of support there. The Des Moines Register ran an editorial condemning these laws. The Department of Public Health in Iowa has condemned these laws and is very much in support of sort of updating the law.
Well, Nick Rhodes pleaded with Adam Plendel to drop the charges. How does Adam feel about the results of the case?
Well, when I talk to Adam now, he agrees that the sentence was very harsh, but he seems to believe that there should be some kind of punishment for this. And he very much believes that he was the victim of a crime in this case. As the case was actually playing out, you know, he did show up at the court. He gave a statement to the court. He endorsed giving Rhodes the full sentence. I think as the case has sort of gotten more notoriety, he sort of mellowed a little bit about what he thinks.
Well, the judge reconsidered.
Right.
Rhodes is out now?
So he's on probation now. His 25-year prison sentence was reduced to a 5-year probation sentence, which will be over, I believe, in 2014.
But he has to wear a monitoring bracelet and he can't use social media sites?
Right. Well, he's, in addition to probation, he's also registered as a sex offender for the rest of his life. So he can't go on social media sites. He can't be alone with minors under the age of 14. He has to wear a GPS bracelet. He can't drink alcohol. He has a curfew.
He can't vote. So this has affected his life.
Absolutely,
for the rest
yeah.
of his life. I'm talking with Sergio Hernandez. We're talking about HIV disclosure laws. 35 states have them. And having sex when you're HIV positive, is it just sex or engaging in any kind of thing that where there is even a fantasy of transmission is considered a felony in 29 of those states?
It depends.
Forgive me for saying a fantasy, because I mean this is a serious problem if there's unprotected sex, isn't there? But we're talking about all sorts of situations that seem to go far beyond that.
Right. Yeah. It depends on the law, and that kind of varies from state to state. But you know, the basics are that sexual exposure, sharing needles without disclosing that you're HIV positive. But then you get into things like spitting on someone or scratching them. Michigan, there's a case there where it was applied to digital penetration. So there are situations where the law can be applied, even though the actual medical science around whether or not transmission is possible is tenuous.
Although positive attitudes about people who are HIV positive have changed over the years, it still carries a lot of stigma, doesn't it, even within the gay community?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We found, you know, the Justice Department, for instance, has filed, I think, more than 40 investigations relating to HIV-related discrimination and all sorts of things, education, state prisons, you know, medical services, rehab centers, housing.
Well, I would assume that's a reason that many people don't want to disclose their status.
Right.
So they're caught in a bind, aren't they?
They are. And one thing that critics of these laws point out is that, you know, there are a lot of reasons for people to not disclose their HIV status, and that these kinds of the threat of these criminal prosecutions might just be sort of another straw on that camel's back, where you might actually avoid going and getting tested and knowing whether you're HIV positive, because if you know, then you're vulnerable to one of these prosecutions.
Well, despite the drugs, HIV infection rates are going up, aren't they?
They're overall, I believe the HIV infection rates are going down or have kind of plateaued. But you do see a very alarming rate of infection continuing in the gay and bisexual community, and especially among blacks and Hispanics.
Is there evidence that these laws are discouraging people from getting tested?
There's not a ton of data on that. There are researchers that are sort of just beginning to poke into that. But there's not a whole ton of empirical data to prove that yet.
Well, have there been any cases where someone didn't know he or she was HIV positive, engaged, didn't tell because they didn't know, and then wound up infecting someone else?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So what happens there?
Well, nothing. Because if you don't know that you're HIV positive, you can't be prosecuted under one of these laws. But something like, you know, more than half of new infections actually come from somebody who was unaware of their HIV status. So it can be more dangerous to have sex with somebody who is HIV positive and doesn't know it than to have some sex with somebody who is HIV positive and is taking all of the precautions to minimize the risk of transmission.
And is there any evidence that these laws promote safer sex?
No. There's a researcher, I think, at Temple University who actually studied this, and he had some conclusions that as a deterrent, they don't really have any effect.
Do we know how the HIV-positive community feels about these laws?
Actually, if you talk to a lot of people with HIV, they're usually the first to tell you that they feel they have an obligation to disclose their status to other people. And I think, you know, there's a study out of New Jersey where I think like half of the people who were surveyed actually support these laws.
If an HIV-positive person is using protection and on antiretroviral medications, what are the odds that they can transmit the virus to a partner?
Pretty low. It depends on what the actual sex act is. So, for instance, in the Nick Rhodes case, it hinges very much on the fact that they had unprotected oral sex. And so the risk there, you know, experts have pegged it at something like 1 in a million, near zero.
On the other hand, it's obvious that the Nick Rhodes partner in that felt kind of violated.
Yeah.
And that was the concern there.
So yeah, I think.
Should people like that have some legal recourse?
I mean, that's a fair question. You know, the critics of these laws say, you know, if you're having sex, you should be aware that there's a risk that anybody that you have relations with could potentially be HIV positive and that you have a duty to protect yourself. But on the other hand, you know, we have a prosecutor in Iowa, for instance, that says, look, this would be like telling a rape victim that they should have been more careful.
Didn't the Conservative American Legislative Exchange Council play a role in helping getting some of the state laws passed?
Right. So in the late 80s, the American Legislative Exchange Council commissioned a task force to draft model legislation to deal with HIV issues.
Now, why would they? They're a business organization, aren't they?
Well, this was actually kind of interesting. It looks like they sort of took their cue from the Watkins Commission, which is a commission that President Reagan put together to address the AIDS epidemic in the 80s, which had made a recommendation that states should consider using criminal penalties to deal with the epidemic. And Alex sort of took their cue from that and put together this task force, which then drafted something called the HIV Assault Act, which then trickled down to various states and became the laws that we see now.
Alex, former executive director, told you that he remembered his members being concerned that people might intentionally try to spread the virus to drive more funding toward medical research. That's a rather tortured logic. Did that concern have any grounding in reality? And why would they be opposed to medical research in general?
I mean, I didn't see any evidence to substantiate that would be, you know, the reason, or that would be a legitimate concern. I talked to a couple of people who were on the ALEC task force. For many of them, it was so long ago that they really didn't remember it at all.
But they pretty much wrote the laws that then were enacted in the various states?
Exactly.
You write that the much-hailed Ryan White Care Act, which funded HIV-AIDS services, gave an inadvertent boost to criminalization efforts.
Right. So Jesse Helms, the late senator from North Carolina, he had wanted to amend the Ryan White Act to include a provision that would have made it illegal for anybody who had ever used injection drugs or had ever engaged in prostitution to donate blood or organs or tissue. And so the sponsors of the Ryan White Act, Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch, came back with sort of a countermeasure and said, look, this would go too far. What if, you know, I once used, you know, shot up heroin or something, and now my brother needs a kidney transplant? If I offered to donate, I would face a $10,000 fine and a federal conviction. Let's let the states decide. And that kind of freed up the states to go and adopt the ALEC bill, which sort of addressed this issue of contaminating the blood and organ supply.
Do they have similar laws regarding hepatitis?
Initially, no. Now we have three states that have actually beefed up their HIV laws to also include hepatitis.
So what is the situation today? Are there people advocating for changes in the state laws?
Yeah, so you know, there are groups, national groups, including the Center for HIV Law and Policy and an advocacy group called the Sero Project, that have sort of made this a strong focus for themselves. There's also, you know, Lambda, which does a lot of legal advocacy work for LGBT.
Is there a constitutional issue here?
Maybe. That's been raised. There was an Iowa case from a few years ago where the defendant's lawyers tried to make a federal case out of it, arguing that it was sort of compelled speech under the First Amendment. That did not gain any traction and didn't make it out of Iowa, but that definitely has been raised.
You interviewed an HIV-positive woman in New York who was raped but didn't report it because of these statutes. But we don't have a disclosure law in New York, do we?
No, but she didn't know that. So, you know, from the story that she told us, she had been sexually assaulted and the person knew that she was HIV positive. But when she threatened to report the assault to the police, he threatened in return to press charges against her and claim that she had not disclosed her HIV status. And since she didn't know that we don't have that law, she didn't pursue the case.
Do we know where Washington stands on this?
The
Obama administration.
Yeah, yeah. The Obama administration has issued a white paper called the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, which is encouraging states and the federal government to do a review of these laws and make sure that they are in line with the latest medical science. The Justice Department and the CDC have been circulating a document to deal with this and offer some guidance to states And there's actually, there's also federal legislation that's sort of in the works to address it.
Sergio Hernandez's article, Sex, Lies, and HIV, When What You Don't Tell Your Partner is a Crime, has been published by BuzzFeed and ProPublica. Thank you so much.
Thank you.